From the Firebird Radio Studio, it's the Authors on Fire podcast with nationally syndicated radio host and producer, Pat Rulo.
Welcome to the Speak Up Talk Radio Network, home of the Firebird Book Awards, the Positive Change Podcast Awards Hall of Fame, our newest book song where we create a unique, one-of-a-kind song just for your book, and of course, this podcast, Authors on Fire. I am Pat Rulo, and today I'm happy to share a Firebird Book Award-winning author, Michael J. Cooper. He writes award-winning historical fiction set in the Holy Land at major turning points of history, all the while promoting the subversive notions of coexistence and peace. His books comprise a series of 5 novels so far and include The Rabbi's Night, which is the book we will specifically highlight today. So, welcome to the Authors on Fire podcast, Michael.
Thank you, Pat.
Thank you for being here, and congratulations on winning the Firebird Book Award.
Thank you very much.
We've got 5 novels in the series. When we focus on The Rabbi's Night, it's set at the twilight of the Crusades. So what drew you to this particular historical moment, and what challenges, if any, did you face in recreating it?
In regards to this particular period, as you mentioned, I have set these novels in the Holy Land at major historical turning points, and a very significant historical turning point was indeed at the end of the 13th century, at the twilight of the Crusades, as you mentioned, and just before the Mamluk Caliphate. So this was a moment where, obviously, there was a major shift. The Crusader Empire had gone on for a couple hundred years. It was well established, but it was about suddenly to essentially disappear from this particular geographic point for all practical purposes. And so I really looked upon that as an opportunity to see how that was impacting people of the region. And indeed, there were far-reaching effects, because we were not only dealing with this struggle between the Crusaders and the Mamluks at this particular moment, there were also the Mongols coming in from further east. They were also clashing with the edges of the Mamluk Empire. And that was also having major impact on the people of the region, on the Arabs, on the Hebrews, as well as everybody else in the region. So it was a time of great change and a great discovery. And I really wanted to include some of the characters who were really serve as figures that people can identify with, because I really want to get away from the large macro historical fact aspect of what's going on down to characters and how it's impacting them on a very personal and immediate level.
I think that makes a lot of sense. It transcends just pure historical telling of it, which may not attract everybody. But when you put it in this kind of a context, it suddenly becomes a lot more appealing, I would imagine.
Well, I certainly hope so. Mm-hmm. And however, the opportunity to kind of work within the scaffolding of history and to have many amazing historical characters that one can look to and weave them in with the fictional characters that also populate the book is just an amazing adventure, especially if you can pull it off.
Just highlighted something I was going to ask you later, but since you just mentioned it, let's just go there for a minute. Your books do feature both realistic historical figures and fictional characters. How do you decide where to draw the line between fact and fiction?
Well, in some instances, it's very amorphous, because when you're that far back in history, the historical record is very sparse. And so, for example, the rabbi in The Rabbi's Night, Rabbi Samuel of Baghdad, this is a figure about whom very, very little is known, apart from the fact that he was a major figure in the Jewish community, spread throughout the Levant, that is everywhere from the Tigris, Euphrates, beyond Persia, all the way to North Africa. And as the leader of this community, he obviously wielded a great deal of influence. Now, the only reference that I found in my mother's volumes of the Encyclopedia Judaica, which she no longer really needed, so I basically relocated them to my house back, and this is before the internet, really, back in the 90s. This was an opportunity to basically look through that particular time period and see if there's a character that basically stands out, but about whom there is an opportunity also to embellish. And Rabbi Samuel was just that perfect character, because even though he was a very prominent figure, the only thing that remains of him were two letters that he wrote to the Jews living in Akko, which is on the Mediterranean coast of the Holy Land, because there was a very troublesome rabbi there who was making major problems from the standpoint of a particular philosopher rabbi who was known as Maimonides, very prominent in that time, and there was a major controversy, and there were very high energy feelings, both positive and negative, about him. And Rabbi Pettit, who's this Jewish scholar in Akko, was a very anti-Maimonidean type in this controversy. He had come from Paris, and they were wondering, you know, who is this rabbi from the Levant who's basically telling us how to interpret Judaism? And so he went so far as to desecrate Maimonides' tomb, because Maimonides had been already dead for 100 years. He sent agents to desecrate his tomb in Tiberias, and he also did what he could to gather and burn the writings of Maimonides. This was a bridge too far. It's all well and good to have a controversy, but as long as it doesn't stray into kind of overt violence. And so Rabbi Samuel in Baghdad had been appealed to by the Jews in Akko about how to handle this, and he was basically going to excommunicate this rabbi. And he wrote two letters in the year, I believe, 1288, to excommunicate this Rabbi Pettit. So that gave me a great character in Rabbi Samuel, about whom very little is known, and I could make up the rest, because there is no estate that's going to come after me. And on the other hand, I also had a great villain who basically was going about business, and he was also a historical character, and about him very much is known. And I could also take some liberties in sort of magnifying certain aspects of his character. He certainly was a scholar, but he certainly had a very negative side. And that really set up a lot of the infrastructure of the novel, because what Rabbi Pettit wants to do is to push back against this excommunication that's pending towards him by getting the Baghdad rabbi out of the picture, by convincing different agents of the Mamluk Caliphate to assassinate him. And what's he going to give them in return? He doesn't have a lot of money, but he does perhaps have access to the secrets of Akko's defenses. Mm-hmm. And this is what he promises them, to give them the keys to Akko, to this bastion that still is holding out against the Mamluks on the far shore of the Mediterranean. So that basically is just an example of how the use of historical characters can really feed into the dynamic and the aspects of plotting, where you know you're always looking for controversy and for suspense and for tension, and this basically is a given in the context of that particular controversy.
Oh my!
So that's just one example.
Yes.
Another example of a character about whom very little is known, if I can go on and on, is the personage of William Wallace. As an 18-year-old, before he steps onto the stage of history in the Scottish Wars of Independence. And then we only know about him from two sources. Number one, the British, who are the enemy, but that's a very good historical record, albeit a skewed one. And secondly, there was a wandering minstrel who 100 years after Wallace, or 200 years after Wallace was gone, Blind Harry was a minstrel who basically gathered stories and songs and legends about William Wallace. And he put it together in a book that was called, wait for this, The Wallace. And for many years in Scotland, The Wallace was a best-selling book, second only to the Bible.
Oh, my.
So William Wallace, as we know him today, really comes largely from whatever we know from the British historical record as an outlaw, but also from these very sketchy legends and songs and stories about William Wallace from Blind Harry, who basically had, you know, no direct access to any information. In any event, it allowed me to take this young man before, you know, we know much about him, and put him at a scriptorium where, as the landless second son of a Scottish lord, he's been sent to become a priest. And so when the Jews in England were being driven out by Edward I in the year 1290, exactly when this is taking place, William Wallace meets these Jews coming from England in France. And he basically wants to visit the Holy Land because he wants to get out of the scriptorium because it's boring, I guess, and dark. And he obviously is seeking adventure and real religious experience in the Holy Land, because he was a great devourer of the Psalms of David. This is a historical detail that Harry does give us. Anyway, so that allowed me also to bring this amazing character into this stage, and do so in a historically consistent manner, as much as we know that history. Anyway, so it was just a lot of fun. And then I could get him together with a guy of similar age who was also a historical figure. That was Isaac of Akko, who would go on to become a major scholar of Kabbalah, of Jewish mysticism. And this could be not only a buddy movie from a buddy relationship from the standpoint of the rabbi and the knight, although a very odd couple, but it also can be kind of a weird, odd couple relationship between William Wallace and this young scholar, who are up there also about the same age.
Oh,
anyway,
wow.
So it was a lot of fun, that relationship between Isaac Vacco, William Wallace, the rabbi, and the knight. And lastly, of course, there's also the opportunity to create a character that would add some interest and romance to this whole male-oriented story, and that would be Zahira, who basically is a beautiful, strong-minded young woman, about 34 years of age, whose parentage is going to be an interesting mystery that is uncovered throughout the book. But in the meantime, she is sought after by the emir, the prince of the city of Safed, or Tzfat, as it's currently known, in the north of what is now Israel. And the only way that she can think of escaping is to flee to the northern shore of the Galilee, where there is a leper colony who nobody dares go into. And so she is basically hiding from the emir so that she won't have to be in his harem. And she's doing that by hiding in a leper colony on the northern shore of the Galilee. And that is where the rabbi and the knight will encounter her. And she will obviously see joining them as a way to get out of the leper colony, because that is a creepy place to live.
Oh, yeah.
And together they travel to Jerusalem. And she, of course, is a beautiful young woman, will pose certain challenges to St. Clair's vows of celibacy.
But it sounds like you had way too much fun with this.
Indeed, indeed. And so it was a way to inject into what is fairly dry history,
right,
although fairly exciting history as well, but the human elements on a very personal level, and how their lives and how their actions are impacted by what's going on around them.
Exactly. Talking about characters here. Well, Jerusalem is almost a character itself in your novels. How did you
Indeed,
capture the spirit and the complexity of this city across different eras?
well, that I have to I'm to give credit to the fact that I arrived in Jerusalem at the age of 18. I was on a year program in a Hebrew academy. I decided after finishing high school, I wanted to do something other than go to UC Berkeley at that particular moment. And so I emigrated to Israel. It was a year program in Jerusalem, and one thing led to another, and I stayed. But that first year was very pivotal because that was the last year that Jerusalem was divided between Israel to the west and Jordan to the east, between the Hashemite kingdom of Jordan, again, across the border to the east, and the state of Israel to the west. And so when I came to Jerusalem in 1966, that was the reality I encountered. And the pension, or the little hotel that we stayed at, was about maybe 50 yards away from the rolls of barbed wire that marked that border. And so every day, during the quiet mornings when we walked to classes, we would walk literally right next to those rolls of barbed wire. Across that was Jordan. And it really was a electric moment in history, frankly, whenever you're dealing with a dynamic situation where there was no real peace. It was an armistice line at the time. And ultimately, within a year, the Six-Day War, the 1967 war, would explode. And that border would be wiped away. But that was a wonderful opportunity that I hadn't anticipated in signing up for that year program. But when it comes to having that sense of Jerusalem, it really was very visceral because Jerusalem had not changed all that much over the millennia. That's obviously a very broad statement. But the fact that after the Byzantine Empire, sometime in the perhaps 700s, 800s, gave way to Islam in that area. Jerusalem was in the backwaters of history. It was a very poor city. It still had a wall that was crumbling. When the Muslims arrived, they basically rebuilt much of it. And the garbage dump that had served the Byzantines was basically the Temple Mount. It was a garbage dump. And when Sultan Oman saw that, he basically had it cleaned up, and they indeed built a beautiful dome, the Dome of the Rock, and they also built a major a mosque also on the Temple Mount. And it became a place that was venerated and therefore unchanged over the hundreds of years. So the Temple Mount, again, was a literal and very immediate reminder of the antiquity. And even the old city of Jerusalem, the wall was also ancient, dating back to about the same period, even though it had been destroyed and repaired subsequently. But basically, it was more or less the same wall. And West Jerusalem had been built up, especially under the British, because after the First World War, which is another major turning point that we're also perhaps going to be talking about, the Ottoman Empire that had supplanted the caliphates of Palestine and that area, Ottoman Empire that basically also control the area for hundreds and hundreds of years. It would give way to the British mandate for Palestine that they received after the First World War. But again, we're talking about a history where, even though there were monumental changes in the backwaters of the Ottoman Empire, also very little changed. And, you know, there was no electricity at the beginning of the 20th century. There were virtually no cars at the beginning of the 20th century. There were no paved roads. This would change and very dramatically, especially as the Germans under Kaiser Wilhelm II came into the picture. But I digress because we've leapt forward 600 years and left the rabbi's night in the background here. And I don't want to do that right now. But I want to give you and your listeners a sense of how I, as an 18-year-old coming to Jerusalem at this point in history, when Jerusalem is still divided between Israel and Jordan, was sort of a time capsule in many, many respects. And the quality of light, quality of the air, the beautiful, you know, pine trees that obviously were fairly, you know, new because obviously they weren't hundreds of years old. But nevertheless, it was an area where at times history did pause and gave people a moment to catch their breath. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. And so that was the kind of quiet that I encountered there. And it was a bonding that really led to the fact that instead of joining all the other people in the year program, a lot of kids from either Brazil, Argentina, or the United States, about 150 kids went back, but one of them stayed. That was me.
What a gift for you. I mentioned at the top that this is so far a series of five novels. Where does The Rabbi's Night fit in with these five?
The Rabbi's Night, even though it wasn't the first written, it was the prequel to all the others.
Okay.
So and basically, without going into detail, I started writing in the mid-90s, actually after the assassination of Prime Minister Yitzhak Rabin and the death of the peace process. That was one of the major factors that led me to even start writing. When I started, I really had no idea exactly what I was writing, but I know I wanted to do this sweeping history. And I actually started off with a monumental, like a James Michener type book that would start in antiquity with the building of the first temple in like 500 BC. And I didn't know what I was doing, but I was having a great time. And I planned to lead all the way up to 1948 from 500 BC. I didn't even get close. And again, people in my critique group, because I was in a writing group, a particularly brazen, delightfully candid person said, you know, I don't understand what you're doing at all. You should divide this up, which was the greatest advice I got. Mm-hmm. And so I basically figured out how I wanted to then approach different segments of the story. And ultimately, The Rabbi's Night then really comes at a point of some antiquity, certainly not 500 BC. It comes in the end of the 13th century. And that is a time when certainly there were tumultuous changes happening in the region that certainly affected how things would go moving forward.
Wow. And did I read somewhere that you were a pediatric cardiologist?
Yes. Indeed, you did.
You fit that in there somewhere.
Yeah.
And
so what happened was, again, I certainly wasn't on that track. I did think I wanted to be a doctor, I remember, when I was in high school, but I had no real plans towards that. Mm-hmm. So when the opportunity came to sign up to, you know, learn Hebrew and to be to go back to the United States and teach Hebrew and Jewish studies and about Israel, I signed up for that year program, and ultimately I fulfilled actually that mandate, you know, about 60 years later, because after I retired from a 40-year career as a pediatric cardiologist, I actually went back to my synagogue and taught Hebrew. And it was kind of interesting to reflect on it. I remember once after class, it hit me that, you know, I had gone to Israel, you know, at the age of 18, with the assumption that I would go back to the United States and teach Hebrew. Well, I did, finally. It's just 60 years later.
Don't you love life?
Oh, indeed, I do. I know that that was a major digression, but I can't remember exactly where we're coming from. Oh, yes, pediatric cardiology. So I decided I wanted to stay in Israel, and I looked into the possibilities of how I would go about, going to medical school or eventually there. And I found out that they basically had a 6-year program that people go to out of high school. That's the way a lot of the world does it. Obviously, we don't have like undergraduate studies like they do in the United States, but in a lot of the world, people out of high school are already on a track, and they basically go to medical school to a 6-year program or so, and it goes from there. So, in order to be able to get into that 6-year program or even apply for it, I was told that I would have to do a special year of natural history and also to improve my Hebrew. And so I did that year at Hebrew University in Jerusalem. And then I applied for medical school and I didn't get in. There were only two medical schools, a total of about 80 positions available. And so I figured, well, I'm staying anyway, and maybe I'll try again next year. And so I studied biology in Jerusalem at Hebrew University for another year. And then I applied again, and this time I got in Tel Aviv. And so I went to Tel Aviv University Medical School starting in 1969. And when I finished medical school, I did a year of rotating internship in Haifa, which is in the north, on the seacoast. And in that rotating internship, I rotated through the coronary care unit that was led by a very charismatic and smart Palestinian by the name of Edward Abu Nader. And I decided that I love cardiology. And after I finished my rotating internship, I began doing a fellowship in his program, in his unit, as to learn to become a cardiologist. Now, I also knew in also rotating through pediatrics in my internship that I wanted also to be a pediatrician. And the cardiology that really appealed to me was not, people like myself now, old people, and their heart issues, although they certainly deserve excellent care. But I wanted to be a pediatric cardiologist. And that didn't really exist yet in Israel and in a lot of other countries. There was only cardiology, which was represented by mostly adult cardiology, since the de demographic is very large from the standpoint of pathology. And pediatric cardiology didn't exist in Israel or much of the world yet. It did in the United States in the early 60s. That started to develop as a real specialty, but that hadn't reached a lot of countries, including Israel. And so the only way that I could do pediatric cardiology was to, after 11 years in Israel, return to the United States, which I did in 1977. And I then went into, I did a pediatric internship and residency in California. And then I did a pediatric cardiology fellowship in San Francisco. And then I had a delightful 40-year career as a pediatric cardiologist in Northern California.
My goodness, you are quite a character yourself.
Character, yeah. Hopefully not a negative word.
No, I meant that in a good way.
Yeah, thank
Oh
you.
my gosh. There's so much more we could talk about, but I think we're going to begin to wind down here, and I want to make sure that I'm not missing anything that you wanted to highlight today.
Apart from this writing career that started again in the mid-90s, when I was really distraught about what was happening in Israel, even though I was already here in 95, and I was already in my pediatric cardiology practice in that year, but I certainly was aware of what was going on in Israel. What was going on in Israel was terrible. There was an uprising, the first Intifada, that had begun in the late 80s and was still going on in the early 90s. And there was also a peace process that began in the mid 90s under Prime Minister Rabin. And it was his death that really struck hard at me, because finally, after decades of enmity and struggle and violence between Jews and Arabs in Palestine. Finally, this former general, the leader of Israel's military during that Six-Day War that I referenced before in 1967, suddenly this ex-general now wanted to be a peacemaker because, as he put it, enough war, enough tears. And indeed, by starting this process that began in Oslo, Norway, this Oslo peace process was to be a stepwise process to create trust, mutual trust, and eventually would lead to, you know, some form of peace. And that was not really defined. There were a lot of loose ends, but it was a sort of a trust building exercise to do it in an incremental and careful fashion. But sadly, as it moved along, there were a lot of people on both sides of the divide. Hamas, you know, that was completely not interested in there being any state of Israel. And on the far right in Israel, there were people who also dreamed of a greater Israel that didn't include Arabs. And so you had these two strange bedfellows that both opposed the peace process violently. Certainly, the violence was far, far greater from the Palestinians at the time, with bus bombings and suicide bombings. There was also a fair amount of anger and violence. Indeed, there were three attempts on Rabin's life before the final one. And there was also a poisonous sense in Israel that they were moving in the wrong direction. And at that point, there was a major rally against violence. And at that rally, Rabin spoke. And indeed, that was before the coming elections and after the signing of the second Oslo Accord. And tensions were running very high. And this very large rally in the heart of Tel Aviv against violence and for to give the process a chance was attended again by Rabin. And after the conference, after this rally, which was attended by the equivalent of over 7 million people, if it had been the United States, it was over 100,000 Israelis. But if you correct for size of population, that would have been a rally in the United States of 7.6 million people. Mm-hmm. Big rally. Be that as it may, the assassin was waiting for him by his limousine, and with two shots in the back, Rabin was dead, and the peace process was dead. So that's basically how my writing career developed, and also how the Intifada sort of also began.
Interesting.
And again, just to put something final on that. I really wanted to create something in these novels that would appeal to people without creating resistance, mm-hmm. by just telling a good story.
Right. Yeah. Well, if you would then share where folks can find out more about you, find out more about these books, where they can get copies too.
Okay. So my website is obviously a good place to look at this series. It has basically right now three books, The Rabbi's Night being the first, then Wages of Empire, the second, and Crossroads of Empire, the third. I'm working on a fourth book that will tentatively be called End of Empire, because I'm hoping that'll take us all the way through World War I, where Wages of Empire and Crossroads of Empire sit. And this will take us all the way to Versailles and basically talk about the fact or outline also how we got to our current situation that we live today, through the attempts at Versailles to create, more, spheres of influence rather than a workable, solution for the people on the ground. Mm-hmm. Be that as it may, End of Empire hopefully will be the last. Now, the fifth book actually was already written. It's called Foxes in the Vineyard, and it's set at the end of this series. But I'm asking people not to look at that one yet, even though it was first published in 2011, because I want to rewrite that a bit so it'll sit comfortably in the context of this series. And so that will be book number five, and that will be the coda. That will be at the end. Now, again, I have all these on my website, and that's michaeljcooper.net. There also they have all the links to all of the different editions of the books, both the obviously paper, hardcover, as well as Audible, as well as ebook. And again, there are other aspects there that I won't go into, given the way I've gone on and on. And again, I really enjoyed the conversation, though.
And I want to thank you for joining us, for sharing your book with us at the Firebird Book Awards, and for our conversation today. And I actually look forward to more conversations with you. I hope that you share more of your books so that we could have more opportunities to talk and take ourselves into bigger and broader directions. So thank you for today.
Thank you, Pat. I'd love that. Thank you.